Happy New Year to all of our listeners in Rome, Berlin, Beijing, Australia, Singapore, Africa. Just not here in California. Pretty much everywhere else. Happy New Year to you. Hi, I'm Cy Kellett, the host of Catholic Answers Live. I am joined in studio today by Jimmy Akin. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and it is an internet open forum today. We're going to do 2 hours of open forum, all kinds of interesting questions, and we already know they're interesting because we've already seen them. They came from the internets. Jimmy, welcome.
Thank you. Happy New Year, Cy.
Happy New Year. So it's probably New Year right up to the Atlantic now, right? Do you see what I'm saying?
If the listeners are listening to this at 9 p.m. at night Pacific time, then yeah, it would be New Year's up to the
Atlantic, the other side of the Atlantic.
Zone.
I was thinking of like it's coming this way and it's gotten to that. Good point, though, right?
Okay.
Not our Atlantic coast. No.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm not exactly sure, but I know that those places I mentioned, it's already the new year. It's already 2019. Those people, it's unfair. They're getting a head start. They're going to get a lot more done this year than we are because...
Yeah, but then we're going to get some time to catch up.
Oh, that's right. We will. Okay.
Yeah.
Very, very good. All right. So all these questions, Jimmy, you have assembled them, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
They all
yeah.
came to us via some electronic
right.
format,
yep.
right? And we might as well get right into it. Steve asks... Can you make a vow or promise with someone under the gravity of mortal sin? If so, and you break it, does it remain in effect for life?
So there's two questions there. The answer to the first one, can you make a vow or promise under the pain of mortal sin? The answer is yes. An example of that would be marriage.
Yeah.
So not all... vows or promises bind under pain of mortal sin, but some of them do.
Mm-hmm.
If the matter you're promising is grave,
mm-hmm.
and if you then knowingly and deliberately just choose to ignore it,
mm-hmm.
the promise you've made, then that would be a mortal sin because it would fulfill all three conditions. Now, consequently, that leads us to the second question, which is if you did break it, would it still somehow be in effect after that? And again, marriage is an illustrative example. In the case of marriage, you're still bound by that promise. Even if you break your marriage vows, you're still married to that person. That's something Jesus was really clear about. And so it can remain binding for mm-hmm. the rest of your life. Having said that, most promises don't fall in either of those categories. Most
okay.
promises do not deal with grave matter, and so consequently, they if you say I'm going to pick up the milk at the store tonight, that's not grave matter typically.
Oh, right.
Unless
right.
something really weird is happening with
right.
it being necessary for
like
you to have milk
in
at
a
your
war
house.
With the aliens, and only milk will keep your family alive.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So
it could happen.
I'm not challenging that. So, in any event, most of the time they don't have grave matter, and even if they do, there are typically unstated conditions in promises. Like I'll do this as long as it's reasonable for me to do it.
Oh, okay.
Let's say you've promised to pick up the milk, but you get in a car crash.
Yeah.
On the way to the store, and things can take a different turn at that point. It
yeah.
may not be reasonable for you to pick up the milk by dinner time, and so consequently, even though we don't bother spelling these conditions out to each other at the time we make the promise,
mm-hmm.
because it would be really tedious.
Yeah, if I do not get hit
yeah.
by a semi truck or the following vehicles, like,
yeah.
that would be yeah,
yeah. So, or even a global, as long as it's reasonable.
Yeah,
we typically don't do that just because it would be tedious.
Yeah,
and so consequently, it's just understood
mm-hmm.
that there are these unstated exceptions most of the time. In addition, frequently, if someone neglects a promise and forgets to fulfill it, well, that's going to even if there were grave matter. Neglectfulness, through no fault of your own, you just forgot. That's going to deprive it of being mortal sin, and similarly, there can be psychological factors that impede one's deliberation. So even if there were grave matter and even if you knew I need to do this, you could be, so let's say, grave fear. Someone's pointing a gun at your head saying you stay in this room and do not pick up that milk under any circumstances. Yeah. The grave fear would deprive you of the liberty of action you need.
The milk wars are getting very intense.
That was, they did for a while in DC Comics, yeah. There was a comic art called Milk Wars.
I don't even believe you.
No, it was quite true. It was a crossover event involving the DC Universe and their Young Animal imprint. However, in most of these cases, such promises do not remain in effect for the rest of your life. Once they've been broken,
right.
It's like, okay, that's off the table. And yeah. So people shouldn't get scrupulous about mm-hmm. this kind of thing. But to answer the question as originally posed, yeah, there are some promises that bind under pain of mortal sin, and some of them do continue for the rest of your life. But that's – marriage is an exception in that regard.
Yeah.
The vast majority of promises don't fall into those kind of categories.
No, because the Lord himself, I mean, weighed in on that one. I mean, you had Jesus
– yeah.
When he weighs in –
it kind of settles it.
Yeah, it kind of settles the matter. That's a good – well, let me ask you this because actually, mm-hmm. I want to get maudlin, but we had kind of a bad year as Catholics in 2018 in many ways. And so say you have a priest who has promised celibacy. Mm-hmm. That's binding for life, right?
That's a vow. It is binding for life unless you get a dispensation.
Okay, so now –
but you got to keep in mind what celibacy is. It's a promise not to get – it's not actually a vow.
Oh.
In the case of a diocesan priest, it's a promise. But they are also bound by canon law in such a way that they are not capable of getting married unless special legal procedures are
applied. Oh, so it's a promise not to get married.
Yeah.
It's not a promise to
but
live.
But Christian morality then requires if you're not married, you're not supposed to be having sex either.
Right. Yeah. I am familiar with that one.
Mm-hmm,
my mother made that quite clear to me as a child.
Oh, good.
Thanks very much, Steve, for that question. It is an internet open forum today as we here in California close out the new year and for most of the population of the earth, it already is the new year. We give you this internet open forum and I'm just trying to figure out my clock here, Jimmy. Okay.
We've got another three minutes to the soft break.
We're good then. I will another question for you. This one comes from Joe. I go to a Christ-centered 12-step group usually held at Protestant churches. We have a testimony every other week. It crushes my heart how often people say they grew up Catholic and had, quote, no relationship, quote, or, quote, we're not fed, etc. What can we do better or how can we reach out and let them know what they are missing?
There's a number of ways to approach this. So let's talk first about how to deal with the narrative that they're using because there is a kind of anti-Catholic narrative that unfortunately is common in Protestant churches to where if you're a former Catholic and you're going to a Protestant church, you're encouraged to repeat a particular narrative about the Catholic Church that either you had no relationship with Jesus or you were not fed and that it's the Catholic Church's fault for
yeah,
those things.
Right.
What's interesting to me as someone who grew up in a Protestant community
yeah.
rather than the Catholic community is you hear exactly the same testimonials from people who grew up in Protestant churches but with a difference. You'll hear people who grew up Protestant say, oh, yeah, I grew up and – you know, I didn't have any relationship with Jesus. I wasn't being fed from Scripture and things like that. And I just was, I just wasn't a religious person. And what the difference is they're not blaming their church for it.
Oh,
they're blaming themselves. They'll say, I was a slacker. I wasn't paying attention. I was young and rebellious. And so,
oh, how interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, so that's the difference in the narrative
uh-huh.
is that instead of blaming their church, they'll blame themselves. But when someone is a former Catholic in a Protestant community, they're taught to blame their former church, not themselves.
Oh.
And so I think it you have to do it nicely, but it's possible to point this out and say, wait a minute. So you're saying you didn't have a relationship with Jesus. Well, the did your parents take you to Mass? Yeah. Otherwise, you can't blame the church. If your parents were the failure point,
yeah, good point.
You know, you can't blame the church for that if your parents were slackers.
Right.
So then if they took you to church, well, okay, at church, you say you weren't fed, and the church has an elaborate 3-year cycle of readings to expose you to all parts of the Bible.
Yeah.
And those got read in your parish, right? So if you didn't pay attention,
yeah,
whose fault is that?
Right.
And similarly, if you were participating in Mass, and you know, unless you were in a sensory deprivation tank while you were there, or just off in your own world, you got down on your knees and said, "Lord, I am not worthy."
Right.
At every Mass. Mm-hmm. So who is this? I don't have a relationship with Jesus or an understanding of my need before God for forgiveness and grace and stuff like that.
Right.
Was it the church that was at fault? The church was the one that put these words in your mouth.
Yeah, right.
If you didn't take them to heart, I mean, how much more could the church have done? It put them in your mouth. Yeah. You were the one saying them, and right, if you didn't take them to heart, that's kind of on you.
Right.
So one thing that it may be needed to do at times in dealing with this kind of narrative is to just point out the nature of the narrative and how it doesn't correspond to reality, and how the same phenomenon occurs in other Christian communities and other religious communities. Youth is naturally, you know, a bunch of slackers at times or rebellious, and that's just part of growing up.
I have noticed that, yeah, right. Yeah.
So take responsibility for your own past failings rather than blaming them on the church. Then, in addition to that,
yeah,
one can talk in a positive way about what one's own experience has been in the Catholic Church, and one can share about the great riches of God's Word that have come to us through the Catholic Church. I mean, where do you think we got the Bible? It is the canon of Scripture was formed and under the guidance of the Holy Spirit through the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And so one can talk about one's own experience. One can talk about the historical debt that we owe to the church and so forth. And those are different ways of bringing forward positive things that can help people who have been exposed to this kind of anti-Catholic narrative.
Joe, thank you very, very much for that question. It's Internet Open Forum, both hours today with Jimmy Akin. So sit back and relax and enjoy the questions as they come. And I promise you, they're good questions. We've already read them. But this is – it's not possible for there to be a Christmas sale. Oh, Christmas sale. Oh, okay. So on
Christmas
New Year's
season
Eve,
sale.
The Christmas season sale. I got all
even
confused.
Though Christmas season goes into January.
Yes.
But the sale doesn't.
The sale will stop at the strike of midnight tonight. So while you are clinking your glass or shouting or blowing into that noisemaker, this sale ends. You can still save money on hundreds of items in our online shop until midnight tonight. Enter CA Live 18 to check out when you visit shop.catholic.com to save 30% off hundreds of books, DVDs, CDs, and other stuffs in our online store. Sale pricing must end at midnight. It says must. There must be some kind of law or something that you can't continue a sale into the new year. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We'll be right back with more great answers from Jimmy today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
I'm really a revert. There are a lot of converts on Catholic radio, a lot of reverts, those who have come back to the faith. And ever since I came back to a practice of my faith, I started praying the rosary, going to even daily mass, God has led me on an amazing journey and used me in a lot of incredible ways that I never dreamed would have been possible.
Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, tonight, midnight Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. If you are in that great bulk of humanity that has already passed midnight, Happy New Year to you. If you're not, well, Happy New Year to you, too. It's coming up, so I can wish you a forward-thinking Happy New Year. I am Cy Kellett, your host here at Catholic Answers Live. Our guest today is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist at Catholic Answers, who just this year, as a matter of fact, just within the last 60 days, came out with a brand new book, Teaching with Authority. And you can find that wherever fine Catholic books are sold, and you can find it on our website at shop.catholic.com. Jimmy, we're taking all internet questions today. Are you ready to return to them?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Chris asks the following. What does Matthew chapter 5, verses 33 through 37 mean, in particular about swearing as a witness in a court case or pledging your word in a marriage ceremony or taking an oath to be sworn in as a government official or even pledging allegiance to the flag?
Okay. So, well, let's deal with pledging allegiance to the flag first because that's not an oath.
So, if I may ask,
in order to have an oath in the sense we're talking about, you have to involve God in His name. You have to take something like in His name or invoke His presence or something like that.
What if I don't know what Matthew 5, chapter 3?
Well, I was going to get there.
Oh, you were. Okay.
But so, I was first dismissing the
okay,
one
first
that's
of all,
not
the,
even an
the
oath.
Pledge of Allegiance, don't worry about it. It's not there.
Because you're just saying, I pledge allegiance, and that's not an oath.
Got it.
So what Jesus says in Matthew 5, this is part of the Sermon on the Mount, and it's in the section of contrasts where Jesus says, you have heard something, but I say this other thing. And so he's quoting a common opinion based on some passages from the Old Testament. He says, you have heard that it was said to the men of old, you know, fulfill your vows and promises to the Lord and stuff. But I tell you, don't swear at all. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anything more than this comes from the evil one. And so in its form that it's stated here, it is pretty absolute. But that's common for the way Jesus is doing these things. He's drawing a sharp contrast between two different positions. And that pointed way of phrasing doesn't mean there aren't exceptions elsewhere. It's a teaching technique that's used to make the principle memorable. But just like we mentioned earlier with promises, we don't spell out all the exceptions.
Yeah.
Well, that's the same thing happening here. It's a form, in this case, of what's called hyperbole or exaggeration to make a point. He's making a strong point here. But he's not taking account of certain exceptions that apply in, by definition, exceptional circumstances.
Right.
And we see that such circumstances exist because you look elsewhere in Scripture and you do find things like St. Paul in his letters saying I invoke God as my witness that this is the case.
Oh, yes.
Or I tell you in the presence of God. This is the case. And so there are circumstances where God's own inspired word uses this kind of language. And so consequently, the church has recognized that we have to hold these passages together and interpret them in light of each other and not absolutize either set at the expense of the other. And so the principle that Jesus is defending in the Sermon on the Mount is actually the second commandment, don't misuse God's name. And so what would happen is people would thoughtlessly invoke God's name or casually invoke God's name. It's like, swear to God, this is true.
Yeah.
Well, if you're just kind of doing that, you know, it's
disrespectful.
It's kind of disrespectful.
Yeah.
And so consequently, That kind of thing is what Jesus is warning against. He's not saying never take an oath or under grave, you know, for grave reasons one can. And so the church recognizes that there are situations in which oaths can be legitimately taken, like in court and mm-hmm. so forth. Marriage, it's a binding promise. I don't believe there's an oath involved, though. The typical words, I mean, they vary from right to right, mm-hmm. but typically the words are, do you take this man to be your husband? Do you take this woman to be your wife? And you say, I do.
Yeah.
And those are the action words, that the performative utterances that bring about the exchange of consent. Mm-hmm. And so you're not actually swearing anything in those cases either. The church recognizes, and you can read about this in the section on the Second Commandment in the Catechism, the church recognizes that there are situations in which it is legitimate to take an oath in the proper sense, but that that we are not to be casually or thoughtlessly doing so, as has been so often the case in human speech.
Yeah, right. Okay, so Chris, thank you very, very much for that question. Let's go to a question from Veronica. Is it okay for a Catholic to read?
Yes.
Okay, that was easy.
Reading is good.
Wow, I'm glad we took care of that. So,
In fact, there's a whole reading rainbow of things out there you might want to try.
Really? Take a look.
Yeah.
It's in a book.
Yeah.
Okay. There's more. Bad, Jimmy. I apologize. Is it okay?
Well, read to us some more then.
Is it okay for a Catholic to read The Poem of the Man of God by Maria Valtorta, even though it has been condemned? I know plenty of people who have these books in their homes. What should I say to them?
Okay, so the title of the book is Poem of the Man God.
I beg your pardon.
Yeah,
yes, I read it wrongly.
It's about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so reading is good. Reading wrongly is not as good.
Okay, my bad.
But
not taking a vow to get better, though.
That's okay.
I don't want to take a hasty vow.
That's okay. But, a promise will do.
Okay.
So this is a book based on the writings of an Italian woman named Maria Valtorta, who lived in the earlier part of the 20th century, and it is presented as if it's a private revelation that, you know, she got these visions or dictations about Jesus and his life and so forth. And it was placed on the Index of Forbidden Books. And so at that point, Catholics, under ordinary circumstances, were not allowed to read it. There were always exceptions where people who had a need to read these books could do so, like mm-hmm. apologists, for example. You need to know what people are saying if you're going to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So there were always exceptions. But as a rule, people, you know, weren't supposed to read it. And then in the 1960s, the Index of Forbidden Books was abolished. This is one of the – Vatican II didn't mandate this, but this was one of the changes that occurred in the wake of the Second Vatican Council. Paul VI made a decision to retire the index. And so that meant that there was no longer a legal restriction on reading the things that had previously been on the index. But there is still – that didn't mean they're all great and fine now.
No.
They don't contain anything problematic.
Mm-hmm.
So it was stressed that the moral principles about exposing oneself to material that's contrary or problematic, contrary to the faith or problematic in one way or another, still remains. It's just not given the same legal form that it previously had with the index. And so now you have to exercise critical thinking and say, okay, is this going to what's problematic here?
Okay.
You know, what do I need to be on the lookout for? And one of the things that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith then clarified a couple of times with respect to Poem of the Man God is it's not a private revelation. It's not to be taken as authentically supernatural.
Okay.
And so even though it's no longer part of the Index of Forbidden Books because that doesn't exist anymore, nevertheless, the Church's judgment that this cannot be regarded as authentically supernatural revelation remains. And so if you're reading it thinking this is a supernatural revelation, that's a problem.
I see.
But, and so consequently, to counter that, the congregation, and this was announced in the 1990s by Joseph Ratzinger, who was the head of the congregation at the time. But
he went on to another job.
He did get another job, okay. Yeah, later. But he let it be known publicly that the congregation had requested the publisher of Poem of the Man God to include a disclaimer saying that the visions or dictations contained in the book are not to be regarded as authentically supernatural private revelation, but merely as literary devices
okay.
that the author used to express her own thoughts about the life of Christ. So if you read it in that light, that this is just a woman's imaginative presentation of the life of Christ, and she uses these literary forms to make it dramatically compelling or as dramatically compelling as she can, then that's fine. It's like watching a movie about Jesus' life. It's going to be an imaginative reconstruction using a certain format.
Oh.
But it's not like the movie is a literal depiction of what happened, and neither is what you would find in Poem of the Man God.
All right. Veronica, thank you so much for that question. It is Happy New Year's Eve Internet Open Forum here on Catholic Answers Live, back with more questions for Jimmy Akin and answers from Jimmy Akin, if we play our cards right, right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Author Mark McNeil spent years in the Oneness Pentecostal movement, praying in its lively services, zealously spreading its unconventional teachings, and rejecting mainstream Christianity as misguided. Then he left it all behind. All in the Name is the story of a man who believed he was among an elite group of believers who followed the true faith when so many others had strayed. But an inquisitive mind, careful study, and the action of the Holy Spirit finally led Mark out of Oneness Pentecostalism and into the Catholic Church. This is an inspiring conversion story you won't want to miss. It's a faith strengthener for Catholics and an intriguing challenge to those who deny the doctrine of the Trinity. Order your copy of All in the Name today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Christmas is coming, and with Advent already upon us, we want to make sure you know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources all on sale at 20% off when you enter promo code CALIVE18 at checkout. With great new resources by Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, Christopher Check, and other great Catholic teachers, there's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to shop.catholic.com right now to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the internet, going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code CALIVE18 at checkout to save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
Tomorrow on More to Life, the life you were meant to live.
We'll look at how the theology of the body can help you live a more abundant life. That's tomorrow on More to Life, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 Central on EWTN Radio. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
I think India is either the most populous or second most populous country in the world. Second most populous, and
after China.
I didn't even say Happy New Year to India.
Oh.
I mean, come on. I left out after. So China's the
Namaste.
Okay, that's in. Is that a Hindi word?
Yeah.
Okay, and it means
hello.
Oh, so. All right. Namaste, everybody in India.
Ni hao.
Happy New. Okay. Now, was that a cat thing or what did
no.
you just do?
It would be meow if it was a cat thing.
Oh, I must not have heard it right. Okay, yeah. So what were
Ni hao.
Okay. What now? What?
That's Mandarin.
Oh, Mandarin. So that would be in China.
Also, hello.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So
literally, how are you? But
all right. I'm just going to ask you to hold off on any Aboriginal Australian languages.
Okay.
Or maybe if there's any. Or a Tamil. No Tamil okay. greetings.
Okay. Apa kabar.
Oh no. Okay, I'm just going to guess on that one.
Okay.
Cambodia.
Nope.
What I meant to say was Thailand.
No.
Philippines is what I was thinking, actually.
But no, that would be Kamusta.
Oh, holy smokes, really? So what was the other one?
Apakabar.
Okay. And
It's another greeting. This time it's in Malaysian and Indonesian. It means, how are you?
Oh, yeah. I had forgotten that from my years in Malaysia and Indonesia. Mm-hmm. But that is so funny. Well, Happy New Year to everybody who's
greeting people around the world.
Greeting people around the world as we head towards the New Year. I didn't even know you were going to do that. That was pretty
Neither
impressive,
did I.
Actually. Oh, Jambo. That's Swahili.
Oh, I didn't know that one.
I know that one. So, or there's another way they say it too, Kijambo or Hijambo. But anyways.
Swahili, I haven't really studied. Swahili is a highly agglutinative language, and I haven't really cracked those yet.
I'm agglutinative free in mm-hmm. my languages because uh-huh. I have a reaction to agglutinative.
Yeah, well, most English speakers do. English is primarily an isolating language.
I'm going to go to questions because we've gotten into where I have no idea what we're talking about anymore.
Agglutinative languages stick lots of syllables together to make long words that can be like even complete sentences in just a really long polysyllabic word, whereas isolating languages tend to break words into smaller groups of syllables and use more words to make a sentence. And English is partially agglutinative but partially isolating. On the other extreme would be like Chinese, which tends to be highly isolating.
Oh.
They have lots of really short words.
The diversity of humanity is so beautiful.
It's awesome, isn't it?
It is awesome, and I just want to thank the people of Babel for all the
And now the people of Google Translate for
who are straightening that back out. Yeah. Matthew
They'll
asks,
call end up causing more and bloodier wars by eliminating all barriers of translation.
Yeah, right. Once we can understand each other, we're really going to make each other mad. Matthew asks the following question. Why at Mass is it take away the sins of the world, and the other part is take away the sin of the world? Matthew, thank you for that question. It's driving me crazy.
So it's another language question.
I know.
How about that?
Right.
The answer is that the way English works, you can either conceptualize or frame a group of things in a way that calls out their individuality. And so like the sins of the world, because the world has many sins.
Yeah.
Or you can frame something as if it's a single corporate entity.
Yeah.
As in the sin of the world.
Okay.
So the sin of the world is just a corporate representation of mm-hmm. all of the individual sins of the world. And it therefore involves frame shifting between a corporate and an individual framing of the same phenomenon. So Jesus is responsible for taking away all of the sins of the world, whether we understand those individually mm-hmm. or corporately, picturing them as if they're one single thing. And it's just a matter of style. In terms of which framing gets used. And oftentimes there's no particular rhyme or reason why a particular framing of something is used in a particular case. It just struck the author of the text as poetic at that point. So what I would assume here is if I were to check the Latin, that I would see a singular plural difference in Latin as well.
Oh, and so it goes back.
That would be my assumption, is that it's not just an artifact of English, because this is – I mean, people who speak almost any language can frame things this way. It's sometimes called chunking, where you take a whole bunch of different things and lump them together as if they're one.
Right.
And so that's just something that human consciousness does. And so I would assume it's there in the Latin too, since we're using these days a more literal translation. In the old days, you couldn't necessarily count on that back in after the dark days of 1973. But these days in English, we're using a more literal translation. And so I would assume it's there in the Latin, and I would assume that as the liturgical text evolved over the centuries, that the people who were involved in composing individual parts of it thought this is the more poetic, moving way to say it in this instance.
Matthew, thank you very, very much for that question. We continue our internet open forum with a question from Jennifer, who says the follower asks the following: If we homeschool our child and feel them ready for confirmation or the other sacraments at a younger age than is traditionally given, are we bound to wait for them to age into the parish confirmation class? Or, as the primary educators of our child, is canon law on our side to pursue the sacrament for them outside our parish if our priest isn't on board?
Ooh, okay. So canon law does not specify a single age for confirmation. And so consequently, the age at which it is confirmed varies highly from one diocese to another. At least this is the case in the Latin Rite of the Church. In other rites of the Church, it can be different. In some rites of the Church, they'll confirm babies as soon as they're baptized. But in the Latin Rite of the Church, a decision was made during the course of history to tend to reserve, in most situations, confirmation to the bishop. And since Latin churches are big enough that the bishop can't preside at every baptism, if you wanted him to be the one issuing administering confirmation, you'd need to wait. And he'd like to do a whole bunch of confirmations at once.
Right.
And so in many Eastern churches, though, they wanted to keep baptism and confirmation together. And so they gave parish priests, under ordinary circumstances, the ability to do both.
Okay.
But in the Latin Rite, because confirmation tends to be performed by the bishop, it tends to be done at a later time, and canon law these days does not specify a single age for that. And so consequently, it's variable based on when a child has the age of reason and the proper understanding of the sacrament and so forth. And that can vary significantly from one child to another. And so it's fine. If you think your child is ready, it's fine to ask your parish about the possibility of confirmation for your child, even though he's not at the standard age. You may get resistance on that. You may have the priest say, no, we're just going to do them all at the same time. Or you may have the priest say, well, your child hasn't gone through the parish program for this, so no. But if you get those kind of responses, then it's legitimate to go to the bishop and say, hey, we think our child is ready and we'd like to see what's possible in this regard. There have been situations in which parents have gone to have their children confirmed outside of the diocesan process. There was a case in Hawaii several decades ago where you had a situation like this arise, and the local bishop in Hawaii said, I don't want to confirm these kids under these circumstances, not necessarily age, but in any event, and actually I need to refresh my memory of all the details here, but what happened was the parents ended up having Society of St. Pius X, people confirm their children.
Okay.
And the Bishop of Honolulu then objected to that, and the case ended up being dealt with by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, if I recall correctly, and they said, actually, this isn't a problem.
Oh.
I'm also aware of situations where, let's say, parents are dissatisfied with the local confirmation preparation program here in the Southwest, and well, Mexico is right across the border.
Oh, so they'll just go
and
over.
So they may go down to Mexico and have their children confirmed there. However, I'm not recommending things like that. But I know those kinds of things have happened, and it could even be justified in some circumstances. But if it's just a question of having your child wait an extra year or two, is it really that? You know, I mean, I'd have to ask myself as a parent: Is the situation so grave that I need to go to that kind of extent, or can I work within the diocesan system which should be the ordinary and preferred method of dealing with this. Even if it, I mean, and work by working within it, I mean not only just taking your pastor's word, but you know, you can petition the bishop and say, yeah, "Hey, can we make some other arrangements? We think we have a special situation here."
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, it's an internet open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Happy New Year to everybody as we approach here in California. Still a few hours left of the year 2018. Looking forward to I'm going to be – I don't know if I told you this, Jimmy, but I'm planning on being perfect for the year 2019. So,
oh, hey, good luck with that.
I'm going to start –
Let me know how that works out.
I'm going to start at midnight and I just go as long as I can being perfect.
Okay.
So I hope that works out. I don't know. I hope I haven't bitten off more than I can chew, you know.
Well, but, you know.
But if you don't try –
If you don't try,
yeah. Right. If you don't give it an effort. Look. Well, you know what? One of the best things that happened to us here at Catholic Answers Live in the year 2018 was?
What was that?
Nick got really good at his job. Well, oh, wait. No, there was also another thing. Assistant producer Marie came.
Yeah. How about that?
And here's
what a coincidence.
Assistant producer Marie. Hi, Assistant producer Marie.
Hello.
Another
Hello.
Coincidence.
You are one of the great gifts of 2018 to us.
Thank you. That's and, very kind.
I'm sorry that your employment ends at midnight. But no one told you that? It was just for the year?
Yeah. Those jokes about not being able to continue and all of that.
You're tired of it?
Those are so funny, aren't they?
They're really funny. But when you're being perfect in 2019, maybe we could rethink them.
Yeah, because that might diminish – bad jokes probably diminish your perfection. What are you here for, Assistant Producer Marie? I think I know, but
– I would like to invite you to be a part of Radio Club.
Thank you. You're not a member of the Radio Club?
I actually don't know if you – do you receive the Radio Club letter?
Twice. I received it twice.
Wonderful. Anyway.
So he's two members of the Radio Club.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we are giving away a free talk on how to survive disasters with Trent Horn right now, which sounds really funny, but honestly,
really
as we're going into the new year, you never know what's coming. We didn't know what was coming in 2018. So
it is
just
funny too, because
prepare yourself.
It's a weird quirk that Trent has is he knows a freakish number of things about how to be prepared for disasters. It's a weird little twist.
I'd like to give just a snippet so that people don't think this is just the strangest thing that we've ever done. For example, one of his little tips is that, you know, you need to have at least half a tank of gas in your car so that if a disaster happened, you would be able to drive far enough away from
it. You'd be able to drive over the zombies and get out of town.
Those are not the sorts of things that many people think about. So
I actually think about that one.
Oh, I do now. Uh-huh. Now I always have half a tank of gas in my car.
I know this fireman. He always backs into his driveway because he
says
it's
exit.
Safer. You can get out quicker or whatever.
Awesome.
I don't know. If an earthquake and something falls down, you can drive over it. I'm not exactly sure what his thinking is, but we get fires here. You know what I feel like, Marie, if I may just interrupt you? I'm sorry to interrupt your perfectly good pitch for joining Radio Club. I feel like we gave away so much free stuff in 2018 on Radio Club, and we just want people to get that in 2019. Like, we gave away talks. We gave away videos. We gave away exclusive interviews.
And we did an exclusive discounts on books. And
I wrote 52 separate letters. Maybe I didn't.
Okay, you didn't write 52.
Maybe it wasn't 52. Maybe there were a few weeks I missed, but it's just we just want you to be a member of Radio Club. We just want to give you stuff. That's
and
all.
And especially now, we're going into 2019 and we're going to be asking for some feedback and kind of making it more of an engaging, interactive email. So this is how we're going to be hearing from you, or one of the ways, and it'll be really fun. So
how do you join Radio Club?
All you have to do is text CA Live, all one word, to 44222. CA Live to 44222.
What if I don't do texting?
You can also go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
And sign up there.
Yeah, you'll enter in your email there. And I wanted to say for the current Radio Club members, I'm going to be sending out that MP3 with Trent to you guys as well. So it's not like if you're already a part of it, you don't need to,
to double up.
Unsubscribe and then subscribe again to get it. We'll be sending that to you guys too.
Assistant producer Marie, you really are one of the best things that happened around here this year.
Thank you.
God bless you in the new year. I'm looking forward to being perfect for the whole year, so I hope that helps in your job as well, to have someone perfect.
Just don't slack off in 2020.
No, 2020, I'm just going right back to my old ways. I'm backsliding.
Thanks,
so
guys.
Text CA Live to 44222 or go to CatholicAnswersLive.com and join Radio Club.
See you later.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
What makes me happy is listening to Catholic radio. I'm by myself a lot, had a concussion as a child, and I can't see very well, but I do work, I go to church, and I'm an on-fire convert, and as a child, more or less, I've learned to have a good sense of humor whenever I can, and I'm very appreciative of everything I have, and especially Catholic radio.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an open forum, but it's an internet open forum. All of the questions today come from electronic means. They've been emailed to us or Facebooked or something like that, whatever the various sources are. Jimmy Akin has gathered them for us, and he is here to answer them. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of Teaching with Authority, among his other books, including Sorry, I forgot the
Fathers Know Best, nope. Salvation Controversy.
Nope. 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist.
A daily defense.
I don't know why it just slipped out as I started talking. But, I will not be doing that next year when I'm perfect.
Okay.
I'm perfect in 2019. So Chris has the following question for you, Jimmy.
Okay.
For the precious blood, are there types of wines that have too little or even too much alcohol to be valid offerings?
Yes. Next question.
I love the – okay, moving on. Yeah. Could I get a few details
sure.
on that?
Sure, yeah. So the exact amounts haven't, for the most part, been specified by canon law. But it is – so obviously, you know, if you're going to have grape wine, it has to have certain characteristics. And one of them is it's got to have some alcohol in it or it's not wine.
Okay.
It's just grape juice. So zero would be too little.
Yeah.
And if it's just pure alcohol – well, then it's not
that
wine.
Is not wine.
Yeah,
no, that's
so,
death or something.
So 100%. So the validity range has to be somewhere between 0 and 100.
All right.
But there's a question of exactly where. And this is something that canon law hasn't defined exactly. It has dealt with it somewhat. There on the upper end, and this is more canonical opinion among, you know, respected canonists than anything that the law actually requires. But 20% is considered, so 40 proof. Above that would be considered invalid. the lower end we have a little bit more clarity on because there have been, you know, situations where priests, let's say, have an alcohol problem and they need to continue with their ministry. So how can we accommodate this? And the solution, or one of the solutions that's been arrived at, is the use of something called mustum. Mustum is grape wine that has had its fermentation suspended.
Oh.
So it has very low alcohol content.
Okay.
The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith has made it clear that in order for it to be valid, it has to have some alcohol. You can't just have grape juice or you can't have wine that you've removed all the alcohol from. But it is legitimate under special circumstances, and you kind of have to get the bishop's permission for this. But it is legitimate to use mustum in the celebration of Mass. So you're using a grape wine that has at a certain early point in its fermentation process had the fermentation suspended, so there's not very much alcohol in it.
Do you happen to know, is this mustum, is it only made for this purpose, or is this a drink that people have?
It has secular uses too, just wine does as well.
Oh, okay.
But in terms of its use in the liturgy, it has to be used in special situations.
Chris, very interesting question. Thank you for that one. Taylor has the next question. Taylor asks, what are the natural rights of the laity as regards worship of God?
Well, so the inclusion of the word natural makes this a particularly interesting question. There's a whole section in the Code of Canon Law on the rights and duties of the laity and of the people of God in general. And so you can look that up, but a lot of those are the way they're expressed are ecclesiastical rights rather than natural rights. A natural right is going to be something more fundamental, and correspondingly, natural rights tend to be more general. So for example, the right to worship God and the right to obey one's conscience in the worship of God. Mm-hmm. Those would be both natural rights. Similarly, the right to receive the sacraments when possible and appropriate would be a natural right.
Okay.
The right to hear the gospel preached, the right to receive at least basic and accurate instruction in the Christian faith.
Okay.
That would be a natural right. The right to share one's faith publicly.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's a public dimension to worship, that would be a natural right. So I would list all of those and potentially others as well. There's natural rights that the laity have with respect to the worship of God.
Fair enough. Transmitting the faith to one's children? Would you?
Yeah, I would include that as well.
Yeah. Okay. Taylor, very, very interesting, these questions. Now, John's question is, I get to do a little bit of reading, and this will help me.
Oh, that's good.
This will help me
reading
practice being perfect for next year. John says, I'm a longtime fan of tabletop role-playing games.
Okay.
In recent years, they've been drifting, like much of nerd culture, towards prevailing ideals such as championing the normality of transgenderism, homosexuality, etc. Promoting inclusivity on those topics is now part of game rules and is highlighted in non-player characters featured in written adventures. See such games as Dungeons & Dragons, Pathfinder, etc. The same trend can be seen in other elements of popular culture, like video games, novels, TV, and movies. So far, it seems one can watch your step among such mixed offerings and skip the offensive parts. But at what point is it too much? When does it become necessary to disengage from popular culture? When does buying or participating in tainted cultural recreation become complicity via one's financial or social support of one franchise or another? What do you do when no major popular alternatives exist, such as in tabletop gaming?
Okay, so there's several questions there, and I may need you to walk me through them
one at a time. Sure.
The first one is, when do you disengage? And this is really a judgment call. Even though he's talking about here about tabletop gaming, which is something I have experience with, because a number of decades ago I would play role playing games and other tabletop games, and I even designed them.
I forgot that about you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't had any recent experience though, so I'm taking his word on this drift in gaming culture. But the same phenomena happen in TVs and movies and music and plays and all kinds of different things.
Yeah.
And so so there is ungodly content in all of these things, and there is a judgment call that has to be made in terms of when do you disengage. Apropos of that decision are several factors. One of them is your own personal background in the faith, because if you are very strong in your faith, then you kind of can endure more before you hit the bailout point. If you're very weak and new and inexperienced in your faith, then exposure to problematic ideas is going to be more challenge for you.
Right.
So, for example, you look
Oh. Well, we fortunately, we have a whole list of questions, so I can just continue with them after the break.
Yeah, so we'll do that.
Okay, so John, thank you for your very thoughtful questions. It is an internet open forum today. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we'll be back to continue with John's questions and Jimmy's answers right after this on Catholic Answers Live.